Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, and for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, December 22nd, 2015, so I have been told. Our guest will be dialing in about, 8 minutes. So until then, a couple things I wanted to make sure I touched on before we got rolling. Number one, post I saw in the Washington Post earlier today, Mall of America sues to stop planned December 23rd protest by Black Lives Matter. I caught this because I was in conversation. I don't know if I brought it up on the program, but they were planning a protest here in Seattle, Washington State. A few weeks back, I think it was quote-unquote Black Friday, right after so-called Thanksgiving. And I said, I think racists, they are going to refine how they deal with these protests and marches and what have you. Because last year they were doing a lot of this after Michael Brown was shot and killed and Eric Garner and the no indictments and all that. They were doing a lot of these protests in different malls across the country, across the world. And I said, I think powerful whites, they're going to say, you know, we're tired, you know, of these niggers coming in and messing up our holiday sales, very important time for white people to make a lot of money, conditioning people to go out and spend money that they don't have for their horror days. And I said I could see them amping up their response to quiet a lot of this stuff down. And that was reported in the Washington Post today, several other outlets as well. I'm not going to read the whole report, but just give a quick snippet. After countless protests against alleged police brutality across the United States since Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, Missouri last year, public opinion is divided about the Black Lives Matter movement. To many, the activists are shedding light on a problem endemic to many interactions between African Americans and law enforcement. To others, Black Lives Matter promotes violence or is even a terrorist group, and they have that in quotes. The battle now comes to quite unusual battleground. Minnesota's Mall of America, the largest mall in America, which has now sued the group and individual activists to prevent a Black Lives Matter protest planned there for Wednesday. Mall of America supports BLM's First Amendment right to free expression, but the courts have clearly ruled that the right may not be exercised on private property without the consent of the property owner. A request for a temporary restraining order filed in Hennepin County read. To protect Mall of America's guests, tenants, and employees, this consent has not been given, and if BLM holds its demonstration at Mall of America despite the lack of consent, Mall of America will suffer irreparable harm. I will stop there. They're just going to give more details. They talked to some of the folks who are organizing in planning this event. Miski Noor, we talked about her before in Minnesota, with the event surrounding Jamar Clark, a black male who was shot and killed by Minnesota's Finest earlier this year. But that will definitely be something folks should keep an eye on for tomorrow. I will have an eye out for that, and we'll try to share information as I see how all of this develops. Definitely, as I think came up yesterday in terms of, well, I think that was Sunday when we were on the air, in terms of driving the cost of business up for whites to practice white supremacy racism. I think last year some of our listeners were saying no justice, no profits. And if whites, if they are dedicated to terrorizing, abusing non-white people, then we should go about the business of being as disruptive as possible to that system. But this is kind of what I thought, and I'm sure a lot of other people did too, that white people, they absolutely refine as they go, change up their strategies. Will be interesting to see how they how things play out tomorrow, the 23rd, as you know, as I've been told, this whole week and everything leading up to Friday, these are supposed to be big days, lots of money for whites to get people out in their malls to spend, and ruin their credit, everything else. Some of the other things that happen in the news we will talk about. I guess one thing that I will say, I have a sound clip that I'll play to kind of intro the program, some of the things that we'll talk about. But if folks remember the Anthony and Opie show, I think they call it like Shock Jock Talk Radio, these two suspected race soldiers, Anthony, I think it's Cumia is how you say his name, C-U-M-I-A, Anthony Cumia. He's no longer on the show, right? If folks remember, I believe this was 2014 when he was out, I think it was in New York. And he went on this racist tirade. I think he was photographing or shooting video of a black female pedestrian. He didn't know her. They were not like together or anything like that. But he was filming her, and she did not want to be filmed. And she let him know that. She got upset because she had asked him to desist with capturing her image, and he continued to do so and was laughing about it and all this. And I think he got on social media and talked about, you know, if I pulled out a gun and shot her and made some other racist comments, and he ended up being fired. We talked about this last year, and even the hypocrisy of him being fired from the show, because they had said things like this, he and his co-host, for years. that was the popularity of the show. We've done whole broadcasts here on the Cows about things that they've said. Well, we had some of our listeners, codified listeners, who called into their show. If you go back in our archives, you can hear one of our listeners, black male. He, when he was more confused, he used to love the Opie and Anthony show. He would listen to it every day. He confessed. And then as he became less confused, got a better understanding of racism, he's like, wow, I've been a dedicated follower of these race soldiers for years, and all the nasty anti-black things that they spew on a daily basis. And he called in and challenged them on some of the things that they were saying. They had like a 10-15 minute exchange. Again, all this in the archives, you can go back. I think it's 2011. But anyway, Anthony Cumia, he was in the news recently because apparently there was video on Periscope of him assaulting his female partner. I don't know if they're still together or what have you, but it got captured on video, Periscope, I believe, and now they're pursuing charges against him. I saw it. It was fascinating. It had a different report that I was going to play in regards to that, but I'll probably save it until later. I don't remember there being any legal actions taken against him last year with the event involving the black female. He was fired from the show, and they even had this big segment lamenting him when they continued with the pod with the Opie and Anthony show. They got his, you know, white replacement to come on and do whatever they were doing. But it was, oh man, this is terrible. And all of their supporters, because they have lots of whites, these are suspected racists too, who listen. And so they were very upset about all of this, and they were going to boycott the network for firing him and all this other stuff. But at any rate, I don't know if his current partner is a white person or not, but that's another one that I would encourage folks to kind of keep an eye on so you can be up to date about what's happening with that. And we can even invest a bit more time this coming weekend in discussing that. I know they have a real popular series, and folks are probably familiar with that broadcast, who he is, even if they forgot the incident from last year. That said, we'll go ahead and get our clip to kind of begin the segment with our guest for today's broadcast. This clip I think we heard this earlier this year. I could be in error, but I'm pretty sure that I played this segment on the compensatory call-in from way back in May, spring of 2015, dealing with the Akai Gurley case. I think a lot of folks, it's been so many police incidents and shootings and so much black death that I think a lot of people just forgot about this. Maybe some people in New York still remember, but I'm sure most folks don't. Akai Gurley, who is that? Black male who was shot in the stairwell. He was escorting his girlfriend to her residence. This was the end of 2014, right in the middle of last year when all the protests and Eric Garner and Michael Brown and all that, he was shot right there. The thing that I remember about this case, Bill de Blasio, man, he's not even a suspect, but Bill de Blasio, mayor of New York, he was quoted in the New York Times as saying, don't connect this case to these other incidents, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, all the other cases that were happening at that time. He said, don't connect the dots on this. These cases have nothing to do with each other. That's one of the super important comments that was made last year, and people should definitely keep that in mind when they process Bill de Blasio, his tenure as mayor of New York. Anyway, really interesting segment. The officer who shot and killed Akai Gurley, non-white male. He has been indicted, charged. That, you know, trial will be coming up 2016. I'm sure will be more to process. But this is a quick sound clip talking about that case and the dynamics of white supremacy, racism within that case, particularly since it was a non-white officer who did the shooting. Context of white supremacy, and we will be right back.
Now let's turn to a police shooting that is drawing national attention. Of all the cases in the news lately, there's only one involving an officer who is Asian American. New York City police officer Peter Liang is the son of Chinese immigrants. He was indicted for shooting and killing an unarmed black man in a stairwell in Brooklyn last year. He has a pretrial hearing today in a case that has divided many in New York's Asian American community. NPR's Hansi Lo Wong reports.
The issue of race came up minutes after Kenneth Thompson, Brooklyn's district attorney, announced Officer Peter Liang's indictment. A reporter referred to claims that Liang's race played a role in why he was charged. Thompson called them baseless.
It did not matter to us the race or the ethnicity of the officers. An innocent man was killed and lost his life, and we had an obligation to do a thorough and fair investigation, and that's what we did.
Officer Liang and his partner, both rookies, were patrolling a dark stairwell inside a Brooklyn housing project. The NYPD says Liang's gun went off by accident. Thompson said the bullet ricocheted off a wall and into the chest of 28-year-old Akai Gurley.
We don't believe that Officer Liang intended to kill Mr. Gurley, but he had his finger on the trigger and he fired the gun.
Thompson said Liang and his partner waited at least 4 minutes before reporting the gunshot. Liang was later charged with second-degree manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide. And now some of New York's Asian Americans are concerned about how he will be prosecuted in court. Last month, hundreds of protesters walked across the Brooklyn Bridge calling for a fair trial. Tom Lai of Queens pointed to Officer Liang's lack of experience at 27 and with less than 18 months on the job.
He's a rookie. I'm not defending him because I don't know what police procedures are. But, I mean, if you're a rookie, how would you react?
Lai sees a connection between Liang's indictment and the lack of one after the police shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri.
They're looking for a scapegoat, and they say, this Asian guy, this community don't vote, they don't have enough elected official, they don't know what to say, let's get them.
And Queens resident Jin Cheng agreed.
Mr. Peter Liang won't be charged if he's a white policeman. It's demonstrating the other incident, like one in Ferguson.
Cheng said the NYPD disciplining or even firing Liang would be understandable, but indicting him on criminal charges, he said, is purely racist and politically motivated.
In America, people say, well, white people is a first class, black people is a second class. What I see Chinese is no class or the last class. So we have to change that.
Akai Gurley!
No accident!
Akai Gurley!
No accident!
In March, another group of mostly Asian Americans protested NYPD's policing of communities of color. They stood outside police headquarters with the Kai Girlie's aunt, Hortensia Peterson.
Peter Lin is one individual within a larger, corrupted criminal injustice system that doesn't value black nor brown lives.
Kathy Dang, who advocates for Asian Americans, said Liang's case is polarizing Asian Americans in New York.
Some in the Chinese community have called for the charges to be dropped because white officers have not been indicted. Those are misguided demands and utterly hurtful to the Girlie family.
Dang says some Asian American protesters are losing sight of a larger problem, police accountability. That, she says, affects all communities of color.
With Kai Girlie, when I'm with the family, I feel so sorry and I feel so bad that they have to see this. To see people demanding charges to be dropped around Officer Lane when they will never see their loved one ever again.
Members of Dang's group are meeting again with the Girlie family today. They're rallying outside a Brooklyn courthouse. The start date for Peter Liang's trial has yet to be announced. Hanzi Luong, NPR News, New York.
The cows. Be great to discuss that with our guest, as well as the article that I first saw when I heard about her work. It was posted at the Aerogram, A-E-R-O-G-R-A-M, theaerogram.com. The article is titled, Why I Don't Date White Men. Fascinating piece. Will be great to kind of pick through and express some of the details that she shares in this piece, and to see kind of how people responded, because this is the sort of thing that I can see a lot of people having some excited views about. For our guest for today's broadcast, she is an activist, storyteller, and politico. She is a resident in Los Angeles, California. She co-hosts her own podcast, Good Muslim, Bad Muslim. And she also writes a monthly column, Radical Love. All of that is linked in the description to the program. She also organizes with Bay Area Solidarity Summer and South Asians for Justice Los Angeles. A real privilege to have her on the broadcast to kind of hear her views on racism, white supremacy, and how they have evolved over her time learning and being an activist. Pleasure to have her on the broadcast. Joining us live, Ms. Tanzila Ahmed. Ms. Ahmed, are you with us?
Thanks for having me. You can call me Taz. Everyone calls me Taz.
Taz, we will go with. Thank you so much for being on the program. Congratulations on the new job. I hope you're enjoying your bit of vacation.
Thank you.
For sure. And again, just thanks for hanging out with us today. For our listeners, this might be their first time hearing about you and the work that you do. Just anything that you think would be important for folks to know about you before we get started?
I'm a Muslim South Asian activist based here in Los Angeles, and I've been doing various forms of organizing over the years, primarily through electoral politics, and I do a lot of writing too. So that's me in a nutshell. But we can dig in deeper.
Right on. Is it acceptable if I ask how old you are?
I'm in the mid-30s.
Mid-30s, right on. I think you've already identified, but just to make sure we're clear, you identify as South Asian, non-white female. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. My family came from Bangladesh in the early 1970s, and I was born and raised in Los Angeles.
Okay. Okay. So they migrated here, but you were born in L.A. or California.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's either called first generation or second generation, depending on who you speak to.
Okay. Right on. Right on. This program, Context of White Supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that we are in a global system of white supremacy racism. I use those two terms, racism, white supremacy, as synonyms, and I use the same definition for both terms. That definition is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That system definitely exists. I think it's very interesting because I think the racism that we experience in the U.S. is definitely the U.S. form of racialization is a lot different than what you see in the rest of the world, just because of how history kind of has evolved here in the U.S. So I've had some very interesting conversations with people in Canada, for instance, about like how South Asian identity construction is in Canada versus the U.S. But of course, the worldwide colonization by white people have led to, you know, this global racism, and how it manifests in each country is just slightly different and really fascinating.
Absolutely. I know we have Canadian investors, Canadian listeners. Some of them are on the line. I see them on the line right now. I'm sure their ears perked up big time. We were just talking about that yesterday, so I will leave that for them if they want to call in and ask a question and get you to give a little bit more detail about what your conversations have been like and how this has manifested north of the border. Kind of before I get started, I'm stealing a question from one of our listeners. She generally asks guests this question. Whom do you think is more confused about racism, like the mechanics, what it is, how it works, white people or non-white people?
Ooh, that's interesting. I would have to break that down even a little bit further. I would say that because of the community that I particularly work with, I've been working in the South Asian community, and these are people who come from Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka. So it's this people with this common history. I would say that who I see really dealing with it are people of color who have access to privilege and were able to assimilate. And I find that those people are the ones who have the most, I think, have the most issues when it comes to racism versus, I think white people know the power that they hold when it comes to being racist. I think people of color who are conscious know what they're trying to fight for, but it's this kind of like in between group of folks of color who have access to privilege and assimilation that is often really tough to deal with.
Wow. Folks will have to check. Well, people, listeners, you can certainly chime in and let us know. But I think that might be a first on the program. I think everyone else.
Oh, did I screw up?
No. Not a screw up at all. In fact, that would be major kudos, in my opinion, because I think everyone else that has answered that question has answered that they think white people are most confused about racism, what it is, how it works. And I almost have to put my head down. I think I told listeners yesterday that for me, the fact that it seems to be that most people think, or at least they say, white people and non-white people, we've heard this from, they say or they think that white people are confused about racism. And I tell our listeners all the time, nothing could be further from the truth. White people are not confused about the fact that they're dominating the planet. White people cannot be ignorant about racism. If you think the problem is that white people need to get educated, that they need to get some literature, or they need to go to the White Privilege Conference to figure all of this out, you are sadly mistaken. That is not the problem at all. It is non-white people are the ones who are confused about what this is, how it works. So that would be major kudos in my book, but I do think that is a first. I think you're the first person who said that they think non-white people are, or at least a specific portion of non-white people are.
Yes, just definitely a specific portion of people that buy into this white assimilationist narrative.
Right on. I want to get to the essay, but one other question that I think is very important, at least. I think it's also very popular to say that there's not a hierarchy in terms of racism, white supremacy, and that's another notion that I reject. I do think it's, in my view, it's very blatant that there totally is a hierarchy in the system of white supremacy. The darker you are, particularly if you carry the label black, the worse you're going to be treated. And I think that's, in effect, worldwide that's manifested. Do you think that's accurate?
Could you rephrase that?
Absolutely. In the system of white supremacy, there is a color hierarchy, meaning the more melanin, the greater pigmentation you have, the darker you are, the worse you're going to be treated. And that's in effect worldwide. Just do you think that that's accurate in terms of how the system of white supremacy operates?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I'm speaking at it from a very South Asian context, right? So in a region like South Asia where it's not race, but it's caste, and I think you can kind of, that can be kind of interchangeable when it comes to how issues in South Asia play out. That's definitely the case. The upper caste, the upper class in South Asia are often the fairest, and the darker class and the ones that are meant to, you know, clean the toilets and clean the streets are the ones that are the darker caste, and it definitely plays. I think often you hear people in South Asia say, "Oh, we don't have racism here." If as soon as you interchange it with the casteism that you see happening in South Asia, you're like, "It's exactly the same thing. This is the same colonized mindset that you have in South Asia that's happening as you see in the U.S. as well."
Right on. I guess last one before I get to the essay. Did you grow up in Los Angeles, like talking with your parents about racism and your experiences growing up here? Or was this something that you kind of got vested in later in life?
You know, I think the thing about being in an immigrant family, my family came from Bangladesh, is that my parents didn't have the language to talk about racism. They barely understood they themselves were acclimating and trying to figure out how to get by in the U.S. And I think back in the 80s and the early 90s, racism wasn't really talked about like that. So, and I think particularly back then, there were so few South Asians, there were so few South Asian narratives happening that it was really complex for them to really understand what race was and where we were on the racial spectrum. I remember when you're a kid, you have to fill out these forms and it says like, you know, mark what your race and ethnicity is. And I would go home and ask my mom, and my mom wouldn't know how to answer that. So I think in that context, like, we didn't really have the language to talk about race. And it wasn't until, at least for me, it wasn't until I started doing work in the environmental movement and I saw environmental racism and we started doing people of color only trainings for activists that I really had to confront who I was as a brown woman in this country and confront the racialization that I was living in. And it really came to head after 9/11 happened, because after 9/11 happened, that was when, you know, Muslims were experiencing this really intense backlash, and we were being racialized for our religion. So all these brown people who weren't even Muslim were getting attacked. So then I had to really confront it in this kind of really deep head-on kind of a way, and thus I've begun my process of doing the work that I do.
Two quick ones. Number one, I have told listeners repeatedly, I still have earned an F in terms of focusing more time and energy studying environmental racism, because that is hugely important in terms of just one of the numerous ways that we are attacked. Is there any literature or any person that you would highly recommend, hey, you should definitely check this person out to get more information on the topic of environmental racism?
Yeah, you know, I haven't really played in the environmental movement in a long time, but one of the biggest organizations that I work closely with is Asian Pacific Environmental Network. They're based out of the Bay Area, and I do a lot of electoral work with them now. But they do some amazing grassroots campaign with the local Richmond community up in the Bay Area. That's where the Chevron plants are. Mm. The community there has to deal with a lot of the pollution that comes from there. And it's just one of those communities which is like, it's a rough community. There's a lot of stuff happening. In fact, this week, maybe a couple of days ago, there was a white supremacist that was found constructing a bomb to blow up the local Richmond mosque in that neighborhood. So it's kind of one of those neighborhoods where things are happening. You know, when you have communities like that, it's always kind of fun to see what kind of organizing happens. I don't really know much more. beyond that, but there's definitely a lot of material out there now.
Okay, I will check that out. The second quick one, if my math is correct, you would have been a teen in Los Angeles at the time of the so-called Rodney King riots. Is that accurate?
I think so. Yeah, I think that is accurate. I lived abroad for a couple of years, and I think those were the 2 years I was living abroad.
Oh, wow.
I came back just in time. I came back in 94, and I think that happened in 92 or 93.
Right, 92.
So I just missed it.
Okay. Were you there for the O.J. Simpson trial?
I was. I remember being in high school and watching the trial play out on TV. We would go in on our lunch breaks and see it happening in our break rooms.
Wow.
Our student government rooms, yeah.
Hmm. Quite a transition to your piece on interracial dating. For this fascinating piece, I would encourage folks to check it out. It should be linked in the description, Why I Don't Date White Men. And even though this piece, it was published at the Aerogram, it was originally published at Love, Inshallah, in September 2015. At any rate, I'll just give a quick snippet, I guess, read the first couple of lines, stop there, and then you can tell us, like, why you wrote this piece and more of the details. So you write, "I have some questions about things you've written about," John asked last week. "We were chatting during happy hour at the annual conference where we meet and catch up. He is one of the few white folks in my circle of friends. It was an article in which you talk about how difficult it is to date," he continued. "I don't understand. You're smart, attractive, and confident. Do you feel like it's Los Angeles? Do you only date Muslim men? Dating in Los Angeles is harder than other cities I've lived in, and no, I haven't dated Muslim men exclusively. Though when it comes to choice, which is what online dating is all about, that's what I would prefer, but I am open. What about dating white guys? I don't date white men, I state frankly. Why don't you date white men? Is it a political decision or is it about attraction?" he asked. "I shift uncomfortably, choosing my words carefully. Well, yes, it started out as a political decision, but it has manifested into preference. I really find brown men incredibly attractive now. I just don't find white men that attractive anymore. Do you find that limiting? I wonder if white men get asked the same question. Do they find their choice in white women limiting?" I will stop there. Why did you publish this piece? And particularly, why did you start with this scene with your conversation with you and John?
Yeah. So this piece is actually one of my columns. I have a column on Love Inshallah's website. Love Inshallah is a forum that came out of this book that I was a part of. Love Inshallah is the book is called Love Inshallah: The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women. And my column is a monthly column where I look at the intersection of being an activist, looking for love, grief, being Muslim, being brown. So I play with a lot of different themes on my column. And one of the reasons why I really jumped into writing this column is because I was just so tired of the same dating narrative that I kept, reading constantly on The Atlantic or these white run sites. And no one was telling the experience that I was living. And particularly, like, I think a lot of the dating narratives are out there for 20 something women or divorcees. There's nothing about like 30 something Muslim, brown, with a social justice lens. So that's the context of my column. So every month, not just this one, but like every month, I kind of play with different themes at that intersection. Because I've been writing this column for a while, I have a lot of, and because of our podcast too, we get approached a lot by our readers and our listeners who want us to talk about things So this topic that I was trying to broach was a request by one of my readers. She wanted me to talk about what it was like to date when you had less than the person that you were dating. And she was a brown woman dating a white man, and I recognize in her story a lot of my experience of being a brown woman dating a white guy, and I recognize a lot of the narratives. I listened to a lot of dating stories because of my column, and I recognized my story within that. So I decided to jump into this super crazy topic. So that's why I chose to write it. And it's been interesting because I think like for me, it was definitely, I was writing, I framed it around my very personal narrative, because I think it's really important that when you talk about race, when you talk about these really heady theoretical concepts, and if you want that point to get across, you need to root your story in a very personal experience. And it was very intentional that it was very intentional how I rooted this story in my very personal experience, because I didn't want people to kind of say like that's, I didn't want people to see what I wrote and just generalize and not really understand that this is a very personal experience. And it's been interesting to see what people said. I actually hadn't read it since I wrote it back in September, so it's been interesting it was very fun to hear it in your voice.
right on. I will read a tad more as we proceed. Specifically with John, I guess that's a part of it. You said just kind of rooting it in personal experiences that you've had to really help people grasp this concept. Within that, you shared that you don't have very many white friends within your circle. What is so special about John that allows white John to be in your circle?
Yeah, I think he's not in my immediate circle. He's definitely a, you know, people that you meet at conferences, and this is a progressive activist conference space. So we just happened to, it was a professional colleague. I would definitely say that I'm at a point in my life where my closest friends are South Asian women at this point in my life. And then I have other circles around that.
I
don't know if that answered your question.
Well, I'll ask, do you suspect, even though you're saying, you know, you kind of met him in your professional networking circles kind of thing that you move, and your really close friends are right now South Asian women, do you suspect that John could be a racist?
I suspect that, I don't know. I don't think so. But then I think that's kind of a loaded question, right? I think everyone carries some sort of internalized racism, and everyone carries some sort of grappling with their race. I mean, I think everyone is racist, and I think everyone carries racism. So I would be careful in how I say that. I do think that the questions he was asking me were ignorant. And I think that it took a lot of compassion for me to respond the way that I did. And I think if a stranger had asked me those questions, I wouldn't have answered in that way.
Hmm. When you say you think everyone carries a bit of racism, do you mean everybody, as in white people, non-white people, everybody? Or are you talking about just exclusive?
I think I do see a lot of prejudices in people of color as well. But I do think for the most part, I mean, racism is by the definition of racism is done by the people in power, showing that they have power over other people. And I think in this world that lies in white people.
Okay. I will read a tad more. So you go on, I'm skipping down a little bit in the column, but so you write, the crushes I developed, you're talking about growing up in the States, California, presumably, the crushes I developed were the same crushes that all the girls in my grade school developed on blonde, blue-eyed, athletic, popular boys. I would later learn about internalized racism and conditioning and how this shapes our preferences and self-worth. I would later learn how living in a society where positive or attractive images of brown men and women were marginalized or non-existent would affect who I thought was attractive. But as a teenager, all I knew was that I was rebelling against my parents' traditional ideas. As far as I was concerned, I would only marry a white guy if I was to get married at all. And I'd get married when I was old, maybe when I was 28. Loaded paragraph on many levels. I guess I would start is this as a teen, understand you're, you know, young, a child. But I mean, that's pretty explicit to say, hey, if I'm going to get married, I'm only going to marry a white guy. Was it that explicit?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Wow.
Yeah. I think growing up as in California, that was definitely what you were kind of raised on. Like what could be the most rebellious thing to, you know, rebel against your parents with us? To be with a white guy when you're in that rebel teenage mode, that's what you think.
Wow. That, even keep that in mind for later in the article, because that might not be rebelling at all depending on your parents' perspective.
Right, exactly.
That just everything in that paragraph, I think it is so huge, because we have this conversation a lot. In fact, I chuckled quite a bit because you're not the first author that we've had on who's had things published at the Aerogram. We had Jaya Sundaresh. She was on the program the end of last summer, and we were talking about Michael Brown. She had written several different pieces talking about the need for South Asians to become involved in this, and that, you know, we need to deal with racism and we have to support other non-white people, black people specifically, in dealing with this problem. And somehow we veered to Mindy Kaling and Scandal. And at the time, I had not seen Scandal. I hadn't seen the Mindy Kaling Project either. So I'm talking about two TV shows that I had never seen at the time. And
yeah,
we got on this topic of quote unquote interracial dating, white guys, non-white females. And she was saying that, you know, I can see where it can be problematic, but I don't think it supports racism. And I was saying, basically, I hadn't seen Scandal, but my opinion was basically that this dynamic has got to be playing out in this television show. I cannot imagine it not being there. And I'm sure if I watch a few episodes, it's going to be there. So I had a good chuckle. And this paragraph right here kind of gets to a lot of the points that I was saying, that it would be nice to just say, yeah, you just meet people and, you know, you fall in love and we have common interests and that sort of thing. And, you know, the color thing, that's not always present. And I'm of the opinion, I mean, we are in a system where what you find attractive is shaped by white supremacy. And people kind of dismiss that all the time or make light of it, like that's not a big deal or that's not important, or you get past that. I'm saying, no, you do not get past that. That is a huge element. And I'm even conversely of what you're saying, we're in a system where you are discouraged from finding dark people, brown people attractive. You don't look at them in the same way in terms of beauty and what's appealing, what's attractive, what's sexually desirable as we do white people. Your comments on that?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think we're in 2015 now? We're going to be in 2016 now. Now you see a lot more brown faces. But I remember being in the 80s that every time you would see a model on TV or magazines, everything was about white people. I never saw a South Asian person in any media, anywhere. And then if I did see people of color, it would be maybe, I mean, in California, it would be a Latina or black folks, but mainly, even that was super rare. So I think for me, it was just so much of that was kind of, you know, like I was taught to self-hate my beauty or to have more westernized ideas of what is pretty, right? So like that my darker skin and that my black hair or that my brown eyes weren't considered attractive. I think it's been very, I think if you look at propaganda and media now, we're at a point where, you know, like Teen Vogue actually has very diverse, you know, kids on their pages. And you know, all these other, you see a Bollywood actress on Quantico, or you see these CoverGirl models who have South Asian people. But I think I was so hyper alert to not seeing brown people that whenever I did see brown people in advertising, I was like, oh my gosh, look, there's a brown person. Because I never saw that. And I think that really, really affects your mentality of what you think is beautiful or what you think is appealing, what you think is attractive. And I think, you know, I never dated in high school, and I always kind of accredited that to me growing up in a strict Muslim family. But I also didn't think that anyone found me attractive because of how people perceived South Asians at the time. So I think, you know, in society, there's been a lot of changes as far as how people perceive people's beauty. That is why I wrote that very loaded paragraph, because I think that's an experience that a lot of South Asian women experienced growing up here. I think one of the really interesting things about writing this piece is that is what you were saying. It's about preferences, right? Like, so this piece is more about how society shapes what we think is our preference. And when people were reading it, they had to confront their own internalized racism and internalized bias to their own preferences. And it really made people uncomfortable because people don't like to think people like to think that if they're falling in love with someone that it's, you know, instinct and magical. But I think there's so much more to that magic being constructed from how society is making us think that this one person who has all these attributes is supposed to, you know, be what is desirable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would even submit, and I think you're totally correct, that there are a lot more images of non-white people, various non-white people in television, media, films, the whole nine. But even with that increased presence, to me at least, it does not seem to stray very far from the typical white supremacist tropes. Like Mindy Kaling, right back there. I hadn't seen her television program when I was talking with Jaya Sundaresh last summer. And she was saying that I don't see those racist tropes in her television program. Yes, she dates white men, but I don't think that has anything to do with racism. And her same logic she applied to Scandal. So after our program with her, I said, well, let me watch at least one episode of each of these. That way, you know, I can at least say I've seen one and I can see how it applies for both of these. Okay, now you have something you didn't have before, right? Like 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when you were growing up, even when I was growing up, television programs, primetime type television programs with a leading non-white actress at the helm and getting ratings, and a lot of people watch this show. But the Mindy Kaling Project, the pilot episode, I think the first 5 minutes of the show, she is upset because her ex-white boyfriend is getting married to a white woman. She's at their wedding reception, some kind of festive event for their wedding. She gets...
Yeah, she's at their wedding.
Yeah, she gets drunk. She's upset that she's been rejected by this white man. She ends up falling in a pool and going to jail. And I said, now, this is supposed to make me feel good about representation of non-white people on television. Like, yay, we got a non-white female and her life is a total wreck because she's been rejected by this white man. And same thing would apply for Scandal. I watched an episode and it was exactly what I thought, where even though you have the projections, the images of non-white females, it's still very much confined to the way white supremacists view non-white people, particularly non-white females in these instances. Do you want to comment?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the Mindy Project. I've been a fan since the beginning. And I do think that Mindy hasn't really had to confront a lot of white supremacy in the work that she does. And she kind of, when she's approached about being brown, she always avoids the question. And she does it in, I don't know, I just don't like how she does it. she actually talks about it in the last chapter of her second book. And I think what's been interesting with Mindy is that you can actually, when you see these actors and actresses who put so much of themselves in their media, you can actually see their growth. So you kind of also see this with Aziz Ansari too. You see their political identity kind of come to its own. I think it is problematic. Mindy didn't just not date. She dated just white people. It's not like she even dated non South Asians. She only dated white people. They could have mixed it up. They could have put in some other people of color in there. And I thought that was problematic casting. But I also think that a show like hers wouldn't have, made it to that point if she didn't pander. There's been a lot of issues with that one, I think.
I haven't, the little bit that I've seen, I would co-sign. It seems very much it does a lot of supporting the system of white supremacy in various ways. And I don't know how you could have a successful program if it didn't. And same would apply for Scandal. I haven't seen a lot of that either, but the few episodes that I've seen, same logic would apply. Back to your piece, though, outstanding work here. You, as I said, you put a lot, and I guess to give some commendation, because I know it can be very challenging to put so much of yourself out in public for just, strangers to be reading about your dating experiences and childhood experiences and all that. So definitely commendations for being a courageous writer. You talk about when you're in your 20s and you did date a white guy, you all had what seemed like a pretty lengthy, serious relationship where you're meeting parents and hanging out for the holidays and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Can you kind of talk about what that experience revealed and even, I guess, the political experience that you all had in 2004, sorry, that kind of led to the end of that relationship?
Yeah. So I think, I mentioned this in the article, I had moved to D.C. right after college, and that was around the time 9/11 happened. So I was at this point in my life where I was really confronting my internalized biases and racism, trying to figure out what it meant to be a person of color, dealing with what it meant to be brown in a world that was experiencing a lot of Islamophobia and a lot of post 9/11 backlash. And, I was also in my early 20s and trying to figure out how to, I was dating and all that stuff. So I got into a relationship with someone who I met through the environmental movement. So we were both environmental activists, and he and I were really passionate about getting out the vote for the 2004 elections, except my way of getting out the vote was through registering and educating South Asian voters. So I started a nonprofit called South Asian American Voting Youth. My boyfriend at the time was very supportive of that. He was on the board of my organization. He was supportive, and he also had an organization he was starting up, and he was able to access with his connections and likability. He was able to get money to get his nonprofit off the ground faster. He was able to get resources quicker, and being in that relationship, I just saw how easy it was for him to. When it came to organizing white folks, how much easier it was for him to access than me. And I think for me that was really tough, because I knew that it wasn't just him. It was the system that liked white males better than South Asian women who had piercings and colored hair. I just didn't fit the kind of the stereotype that would make me likable to people. So I think that really that was really tough, and then dating someone white when you're coming to your racialized racial consciousness is really interesting too. And I think there's a lot of women that go through that experience where they're in this relationship and they're coming to their own political identity, yet their partner is kind of veering away from the way that they themselves are discovering their political identity. And that was definitely what we were going through in our relationship. Eventually he left me for someone else. And that was also really tough. I wouldn't say that that was why I stopped dating white people. And I think that was a lot of the feedback that I got for this article was people were saying, well, you stopped. It's because he cheated on you. And that's why you don't date white people. And that's not the case at all, because I think it was really more about the fact that I was really trying to address the fact that the way he was able to access privilege, the way I wasn't able to access privilege, whether it was whiteness or classist or maleness that he was accessing and how I didn't have any of that. I was really trying to highlight those differences. And I think whether he cheated on me or not, like I would still be dealing with those systems of oppression in this relationship.
Wow. Just to tease out several things, I guess number one, kind of some of the comment or scrutiny that you're receiving from people who read this piece, who kind of took the bent that, oh my gosh, this Ahmed woman, she's just tainted and mad because he left her, he cheated on her, and so she's upset and taking it out on white men. Is that kind of the sentiment that some people were?
Oh yeah,
okay,
absolutely.
Okay. The second thing, when you said that he had easier access to privilege than you did in terms of organizing and getting money for his political project more so than you, white people were more comfortable with him more so than you, do you think it would be, which term, I guess, do you think would be most accurate to say that he had easier access to white privilege, easier access to white power? Which term do you think is most accurate?
I don't know what the difference is, honestly. How would you define the difference?
Well, I think, at least in my view, I think power is a more accurate word. I think privilege dilutes things. I think when we're talking about the system of racism, white supremacy, I define power as the ability to do. And white people have an immensely greater ability, easier ability, as you said, to get things done, whether it's doing correct things or doing incorrect things like mistreating non-white people, which they do a lot of. And I think white people try to shift away from that, the deliberate maintenance of their system to make sure that they have power over, to have power and the ability to dominate non-white people. I think privilege gives the impression that this is just very unintentional, that I'm a very passive recipient of goodies, that, you know, I just go to bed and I wake up in the morning and, oh, my knapsack is filled. I got, you know, a few gift cards for Starbucks and I can go to the tanning salon. I got some money and all these goodies just appeared here. And that is not the case at all. White people do a lot of work. Again, going back to what I said, white people are not ignorant. They invest a lot of time, mm-hmm. deliberate energy in making sure that they maintain power to dominate non-white people. I think that, at least in my view, that's a huge distinction. Does that make sense, or am I talking crazy?
No, yeah, no, that totally makes sense.
Okay. Have a sentence, quick one here, where you write, and this is dealing with this relationship, you write that our relationship came to an explosive end near election day 2004. I promised myself that I would never actively date a white man again. I needed to get on solid ground on what it meant to be a Desi. Am I saying that correctly?
Desi.
An American and a racial justice activist. I hated the feeling of constantly being reminded of how little power I had as a woman of color. It felt hypocritical to my political beliefs to be dating white. The last sentence there, particularly, how did you experience or feel this hypocrisy in being with this white man?
Yeah, I think we would, I was working in an organization, I mean, diversity trainings were the hot things back then. And I was working in this organization where there would be a white caucus and a people of color caucus. And we would have these conversations about race. And I was not able to really figure out what it meant to be a person of color who's dating this white person while trying to figure out what my racial politics were. I mean, I think that's part of being in your early 20s, right? Like you're trying to figure out identity and politics, and when you didn't, like for me, I graduated undergrad in 2001. I didn't, in the late 90s, early 2000s, that kind of racialized construct wasn't really accessible in college for me. So I think I was just like grappling with all of this stuff, and I just knew that I couldn't really figure any of that out if I always had to use me in relation to a white person. And I needed to figure out who I was on my own before I could enter in not just relationships, but just enter into any relationship with any kind of people without knowing who I was as a person.
Hmm. Shout out to Pam. She's been one of our favorite guests on the program, author of many books. She says all the time, you cannot fight against racism in the daytime and then lay down with a white person, that it's really going to cause a lot of confusion in terms of your thinking and being able to process. And I think she would say just really being able to be honest with yourself about racism, what it is, how it works, and even how it impacts and is operating within this relationship with this white person that you're with. She says that all the time. Did you ever feel that at any point that you were maybe having some difficulty even being truthful with yourself about racism as you were trying to grasp these dynamics when you were still with this white man?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the interesting things about when you're in relationships is that when you're spending time with your significant other, that's supposed to be your downtime. That's supposed to be your time when you're your best self, your whole self, where you can finally just, you know, relax. And I think when you're an activist, when you do racial justice for a living, so much of your career is spent on the front lines, talking to people, writing about things, organizing people, and that's you're educating people. And you know, I just don't feel like educating when I'm at home, and that's the choice that I've made. I know that for most people who don't choose racial justice careers, it's a lot easier for them to be able to take on that role of educating their partners. But for me, since I was already spending most of my waking life taking on the responsibility of doing activism, I just didn't want to also take on that role of educating in the bedroom. That just was not comfortable for me.
Wow. were you all talking about racism on a regular basis?
We would, because I would want to talk about the things that I learned about at work, and it made for some very uncomfortable conversations. I think one of the interesting things was that he also gained a lot from these conversations too, which is great, I guess, but I think my relationships that I've had with men of color have been so much more nuanced when I talk about race and when I talk about the things that I'm dealing with in my career, that it's definitely a different experience.
Hmm. Wow. I'm scrolling back up just some of the uncomfortableness that you're relating from that experience. It seemed there was a hint maybe of that in the conversation that you had with John when he was asking, you know, hey, wait a minute, what do you mean you don't date white guys? What's going on there? Where you expressed that you were kind of shifting and a little bit uncomfortable in explaining this to him. Was there a little bit of discomfort in even explaining to John at the beginning of the essay where you talked about that your preference for, hey, I don't date white men anymore, and sharing that with him?
Yeah. There definitely was discomfort there. Absolutely.
Okay. And rooted in what was the source of that discomfort?
Well, I mean, there's also just like discomfort in talking about dating too. I think that there's this discomfort of having to talk about dating all the time, which I think kind of falls, like, you know, when you're single and you're in your 30s and you're a storyteller, like that's, you're always expected to have like some really quirky and witty dating story. And then with him, it was also kind of like, because I knew he was a reader, right? So he reads what I write. So I also get a lot of questions based on the things I write, and because I write so vulnerably and personally, I also feel very uncomfortable with the things that I talk about. And yeah, it was, I wanted to figure out how to be able to get across that I didn't date white people without offending him.
Wow.
Which is pretty deep too, right? because, like, why should I really care about, like, people's feelings on, like, who I date and who I don't date? But I think for me, I wanted to figure out how to present the situation without with being able to, like, hold space to have a conversation instead of just turning people away. But I think for most people, though, I would just turn people away. I mean, I've had to have this conversation a lot since this article came out, and I've had some very uncomfortable conversations with people who I don't care about.
Wow. can you kind of share the details of one of those conversations? Like, what was, I guess?
Yeah. Okay. So it was like the weekend after this article came out, and people, I was at a party and everyone was talking about it, and there's these two white guys in from out of town. And it was actually really weird because the party was full of racial justice activists, so I kind of expected that everyone was kind of in the same mindset, but I didn't realize that these two guys were friends of friends. And the guy was just like, oh, what's this article that you wrote? I was like, it's just this article I wrote about why I don't date white guys. And he's like, why don't you date them? I was like, well, you can just read the article. He's like, no, tell me. I was like, well, it's kind of long. And then he's like, no, tell me. And I was like, okay. So then I basically regurgitated my very long article to him. In I took up 15 minutes because, it's a long column. But I also think that to be honest to what I was trying to get across, I wanted to be very detailed. And then after I finished, he was just like, he didn't have any follow-up. I was like, do you have any questions? And he just kind of just didn't answer. And I was like, well, don't ask if you don't want the answer. It's not simple.
Wow. I mean, did he just walk away? Like, when you spent 15 minutes?
He kind of walked away. He kind of was just like, I can't believe this girl's still talking to me. I think 10 minutes. And I was like, I'm going to finish this out. You are a white man that just asked me a question about this. You're going to have to listen to this. And he couldn't walk away because he was cornered because we were at a party. So,
wow.
You know, I'll do stuff like that. I'm kind of a punk in that sense.
Wow. One of the really important points of that I hope is not lost on people on the program. I encourage all the time. I tell our listeners, because this program is designed for non-white people, I've concluded that white people are not going to voluntarily stop practicing racism, that unfortunately is just not the case. So I tell non-white people that you should not have white friends because, I mean, just the likelihood is that you're going to be friends with a racist, that's what it is, and that's not going to be constructive for you developing solutions, being honest about this problem, and moving forward to resolution, us getting rid of this permanently. And you shared, I can give personal. I had a white friend when I started this work, when I started doing the radio program and everything, white female. She was married to a white man, so I guess I had two white friends because I was friends with her husband too. And we would talk about this, the same thing. You do this work and you want your time with your friends where you can just kick it. We can relax, just have fun. Doesn't have to be stressful and all that. We can just, unwind and just have a good time. And something about the radio program came up, and I have been talking about this subject for years now and saying that, oh man, the sex area is huge. This is a big one. Having sex with white people, sexual relationships with white people, that's a big no-no. Those issues are there. It's a huge way that white people are able to practice racism against us. And they were vehemently opposed to that stance. And I could never figure out, why they're married. They're not in the dating pool or what have you. It's not like it's having a personal impact on them. And the white female that I was friends with, she says, why are you spending so much time focused on racism anyway? There are tons of problems in the world. Like, once you solve one problem, it's just something else. And I remember being so hurt. Like, what? It was like she was totally invalidating everything that I was doing, like the significance of this. And I mean, she was informed. This was not a dumb white person. This was not ignorance. She is the person who recommended that I read Medical Apartheid by Harriet Washington. Hugely important book. I hope folks check it out. Book club should be coming up. But this is not ignorance. This is when she had written a college term paper about how her father was racist and all of his views and things that he did and what have you. And in the space of that conversation, particularly when she said, why are you doing this? You're wasting your time. You just focus on something else. And I'm trying to explain, and I felt like I was pulling my punches. And I said, man, if I was just talking to any other white person, oh, man, like, it would be on. It would be no regard for how you feel, what you think. Like, I don't care if you're upset, if we never speak again. Like, oh, well, like, I would just say truth. I would speak honestly the same way that I do on the radio program. And I was not doing that. And I said, you know what? I will never have another white friend. This is never going to happen again where I'm in a position where I am managing and concerned with a racist's feelings. That is absurd, particularly for me as a victim of racism. Just equal, get at least some measure of balancing out since everybody's, you're doing so much sharing of personal experiences. Just, I was going to move on to your mom, but did you have any comments you wanted to get in, any response?
I mean, not really. I think I also, I'm at a point where I don't have many white friends. I've been really grappling with this whole, like, having white friends or not having white friends thing, because I think one of the things that I've been, which we see in the media, is that people are less likely to be Islamophobic if they have a Muslim friend. And so many white people just have white friends, and they don't have any interaction with the Muslim community. And so I've been really thinking about, like, what does it mean? What does it mean to be able to make people comfortable with people so that they don't, what does it mean to make white people comfortable enough with brown people so they don't, you know, kill us? So I've been thinking a lot about that. But I think one of the one of the things that I really think about is that I know what my politics are, and I'm very strong about my politics, about how I stand, and I'm very verbal about it. And when I write my stories and when we talk on our podcast, we very much center the narrative on our experiences. We don't try to explain for the white gaze. And if white folks can get along with that, then I'm down with them. Like, if I don't need to do any educating and they are following us along for the ride, then I'm cool with that. So I think that's kind of one of the things that I've been thinking about, like, what is it about having white folks in my life that makes me uncomfortable or not comfortable? I think it's if they have down politics and I don't have to teach them and they're able to come along without me having to cater to their white gaze or their white feelings, then I'm cool with it. It's just that combination is very rare, honestly. But hey, I'm hopeful.
Not opposed to hope. I'm not opposed to hope. I hope we can get this problem solved ASAP. I can only say, because I hear that a lot, particularly I hear that a lot around different issues, like what you were saying about data suggesting that whites are less likely to be Islamophobic if they have Muslim friends, and just to apply that to white supremacy in total. I've just seen too much evidence that white people can spend a lot of time around non-white people and still be racist. Like, they can marry non-white people, have children with non-white people, and it does not limit, it does not stop them from their dedication to abusing, terrorizing non-white people. I just haven't seen that. And I mean, white people in this area of the world have been around black people for a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're still doing the same, they're still engaged in the same behaviors, the same mistreatment, the same violence, the same abuse against non-white people. So that to me, that entire argument just rings very false, particularly when I hear it applied to school, that, you know, we need to have what they call integrated schools. We need to have these children around each other so that they won't be racist. And it's almost laughable when I hear those type of suggestions, just because there's so much history of white children and non-white children being around one another, and then the racism still clicks in by the time that they're 13, 14, 15, somewhere around there. It's like, oh, wait a minute, I'm white. You dark people, you know, you're not on my level. Like, they understand, they get it, but perhaps I'm wrong.
I think there's an element of power, though, when it comes to that, right? So I think one of the things that I'm really thinking about is a lot of our listeners for our podcast. So I have a podcast called Good Muslim, Bad Muslim. We get a lot of fan mail from, you know, white folks in the middle of the country who I don't know. I mean, we got a lot of media, so we got covered by NPR. So we get a lot of, you know, NPR listening Midwest people who are listening to our podcast. And our podcast is not made for white people. It's definitely centering you know, the narrative on our experiences. It's like it's a two girls talking to each other podcast. But, you know, it's really refreshing to get these fan mails from these listeners who are like, hey, I listened to your podcast. I don't know many Muslim people, but this, it's so cool to listen in. And I think that's, even though it might just be like a handful of people, I feel like it must be doing something if we can like get people to have this kind of eavesdropping type conversation. I hope it's doing something.
I hope so as well. I guess I can only say that I have also unfortunately seen that white people, racists, they do study their victims. And I know that there are white people who listen to this program. I don't get fan mail from white people, which is totally cool. But I do know that they do listen and study non-white people. And for many racists, in listening or reading the work of non-white people, it allows them to camouflage their racist intent so that they can be around non-white people and they're not suspected. They sound like white people who get it. They understand and they're on board. They're about social justice. They know all the correct terms to say. They know the authors to cite. Oh, I read Ta-Nehisi Coates, or I watch Melissa Harris Perry or whomever. I go to the Aerogram every day and read all their posts or what have you, where they just end up sounding like they're not racist, but that ends up not being the case. I've seen enough of that to be very dissuaded about white people who tune in or read a lot of non-white people's works down through the years.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Really quickly, and I'll nab some of the folks who dialed in if they have any questions that they want to get on what we've discussed. You shared also about your mom. That's why I said it was so funny when you were saying as a teen, you're thinking, hey, I can rebel against my parents being attracted to and dating these white guys. When you're having a conversation with your mom later in life about, you know, hey, I'm not married yet, and do you have any advice or tips on dating and going down the road leading to marriage? And she says, hey, why not a white guy? And you kind of express your shock about all this. Can you kind of share with our listeners your response?
Yeah. I think I was in my late 20s by then, after I had had my racial awakening, I guess. You know, like South Asian families are very much like, you got to get married by the time you're in your early 20s. So I was the ripe old age of 28. Or something like that, and she was like inquiring why I wasn't married yet. She was like, you know, you can date white, you can find someone white. It was never dating, actually. I take that back. It was always like, you know, it's always meet someone and then get married. She's like, if you have a white person, that's fine. I was like, no, mom, I would never be with a white person. And it was interesting because, you know, in these South Asian families, in these Muslim families, you're raised to not date. You're supposed to. It's a very arranged marriage mentality. You know, your parents will find you someone and then you just get married. And so growing up, it was like white folks were definitely, I was supposed to get married to a Bangladeshi Muslim man of my parents' choosing. And then all of a sudden, you know, in my late 20s, because they were so desperate, they were letting me know that I could date whoever I wanted. But, you know, she did say white guy. She didn't say a Latino guy or a black guy either. So there's that too. I think it might be different if she were still around. I'm sure. I think the older you get, the more desperate your parents get when you didn't seem paired up with someone. So, you know, their rules kind of flex the older you get.
Wow. I remember, I think that came up with some of our other guests, South Asian guests that we've had on the program, and they at least told us that their parents would give the nod if it was a white guy. They would not give the nod if it was a black guy. They were coming home and saying, I want to marry this black. I said, no, that is not going to fly in the household.
Right.
I guess really quick, I did want to ask as well, because when I was reading your posts on the Aerogram, and I was just looking over to the side for other posts that they had tweeted, and a different author had written about Sandra Bland. And the title of the post was In the Aftermath of Sandra Bland, Why South Asians Need to Speak Out in Support of Black Lives Matter. And I will state again, just so listeners are clear, Ms. Ahmed, she did not write this piece. So right on, just so that's clear. But I did want to get your thoughts on it. Just kind of the concluding paragraph in the piece, it reads, "We think that if we behave, that if we do what they want," meaning white people, "that if we are compliant, that we will prevail. That is a myth. That is a fantasy. Our role in perpetuating the model minority myth means that we may unknowingly be perpetuating white supremacy itself. The insidiousness of white supremacy in the United States of America is the ability to convince you that you have a chance, an opportunity, a dream. Our silence is disingenuous to our own colonial heritage. Our silence in the wake of two odd centuries of colonial rule in South Asia is not simply embarrassing, but brings to light that we too, as a community, have bought into the lie of America, the well-taught refrain amongst our families that these things don't happen to us, is now willful blindness." Your thoughts on this piece and the call to get more South Asians to be focused on the problem of racism?
Yeah, I think that's very eloquent. I'm trying to figure out who wrote it. I've been doing a lot of South Asian activism in the U.S. For a while. I'm involved with South Asians for Justice in Los Angeles. Out here, we've done events with Black Lives Matter. I myself went to Ferguson with an Asian American artist contingent at the 300 day point after Mike Brown died. And I do think that the South Asian community does need to get in line with Black Lives Matter. I think where there's a lot of intersections that are there, but I think that the at the core of racism in the U.S., that's on the backs of Black lives. And for us to dismantle and to smash white supremacy, we need to uplift Black lives, and we need to, smash anti-Blackness in our community. I think it's very difficult on how that's going to happen, and I think a lot of what we have to deal with in the South Asian community is this, super colonized mentality, and so many of the migration, the default migration pattern of South Asians to this country have been based on the 1965 Immigration Act. So because of that, a lot of the people that came over were doctors and engineers in that first wave of migration. Because of that, there was this, this myth of model minority myth was perpetuated, and then people thought that if they could just pull themselves up by the bootstraps that they can make it work. So there's so much unpacking that has to be done, and I think this is one of the first steps that you started hearing in our community, was that figure out how to get South Asians to be in support of Black Lives Matter. And it's been interesting to see how it's been playing out in the community, but it's still tough.
Our guest last summer, Jaya Sundaresh, she also has work published at the Aerogram. She had very similar sentiments. In fact, she said she did write. She's written about Michael Brown and Ferguson. She wrote several pieces about that are published at the Aerogram. But she had said that she had wanted to write more about racism, but she said that the view that she had in 2014 is that a lot of South Asians, they were not interested. Hearing a lot of commentary on racism, particularly if it was going to be racism dealing with Black people being abused, that they just were not interested. We don't want to read that. You can talk about some other subject matters, and talking about honestly talking about how anti-Blackness is a major problem that needs to be addressed, and why this is something that, hey, we need to be on board with and supporting as well. I guess in that vein, I did see more content on the Aerogram now. This was a year's past, so I do see more content now. The piece that I read from in the aftermath of Sandra Bland, the author, Shyama Rajendran, I hope I'm saying her name correctly, but that's the author. Great piece. I posted it on Facebook. I tweeted it as well. Great piece. But it looks like there could be more content, so maybe they're making progress at the Aerogram and getting more people to focus on this as a problem that folks need to be concerned about. Before I nabbed some of the callers, I did the piece that I played at the very beginning with the shooting death of Akai Gurley in New York. I think that could end up being fascinating, since the officer who killed Akai Gurley, black male, 2014, Peter Liang, he is a non-white male, Chinese-American, and you heard some of the commentary, or yeah, I think you were on the line then, so you heard some of the commentary. It will be fascinating when the trial comes up to see how that plays out. Do you have any thoughts just based on what you heard on the clip?
Yeah, the organization I was, the woman, one of the women speaking, Kathy, was my roommate. So I've been loosely following this case, and I think it's going to be tough. I think there's the LA Asian American community, particularly. I think we're dealing with he's of a Chinese background, right? So I think there's a lot of the issues that you see in the South Asian community are also you see happening in the Chinese American community too, with this assimilationist narrative and, you know, trying to fit into white supremacy. I think it's going to be a tough one, but I think there's enough at this point. There's a lot of radical Asian American organizers and not so many organizations, but definitely activists and organizers on the ground who are doing the work to kind of, you know, break this all down, and I think it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I'm a lot more optimistic that it'll play out the way that it's supposed to, as far as radical politics are concerned, than it would have been maybe like 5-10 years ago. I think there's been a lot of movement in the Asian American movement to build solidarity and to really have a stronger way of fitting into a people of color radical movement than we did in the past. And I think that'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
What would that look like in your view, if there's a more radical bent on where the activism is in the Asian community, and for this case specifically, what would that look like in your view?
Well, I don't know the details of this case, but I would hope it would be, you know, anti-police. Is my leaning, but I honestly need some more detail from the case.
Oh, okay. More detail will be coming. This will be one I would definitely encourage the folks to pay attention in 2016 as this case develops and you ultimately get to the trial. Definitely one to keep an eye out for. I would say quickly in this case, even though I definitely think that there should be prosecution, I definitely think there should be some punitive action and a conviction for what happened, this unarmed black male just being shot in a hallway. To me, at least, this would be one where white supremacy wins again, because I do think if this officer had been white, we would be looking at a very different case. And in fact, I submit if this officer had been white, this could have played out exactly the way Michael Brown did and Eric Garner, where we don't even get an indictment. Sorry. It was confusing. Maybe it was bad training, but certainly nothing criminal. I definitely think when the officers are non-white, even the case that's happening in Baltimore right now, hey, no problem. You wanted a conviction? Fine. Non-white person, we'll go ahead and put them through the system, and we might even give them some time where they have to go to prison for shooting a black person. But that'll be something folks can pay attention to. You all can, you know, add your own thoughts as we roll along. We'll nab some of the folks who called in really quick and see if they have any questions just based on what we've heard or what we've discussed so far. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Taz? Your line should be open. Thomas in New York.
Absolutely. Can I be heard?
Your volume is a little low. Could you speak up, please?
Sure thing. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the guests.
Greetings.
Greetings.
Hi.
How are you? I have a few questions for you. First, I wanted to know, in India, in Bangladesh, would you be considered dark skin or light skin? I was looking at your picture.
I don't know.
You don't know?
It's a weird question to ask.
Well, because you said it's sort of like a caste system, you know, and I just want to know where would you have fit if you had grown up there as opposed to in America? Would you be in the upper caste or in the lower caste?
So the caste system doesn't really exist in Bangladesh the way it exists in India, because Bangladesh is more of a Muslim country and casteism exists in, you know, Hindu religions and Hindu cultures more. So, like, I think kind of I'm sure that there's residual casteism in Bangladesh, but I was never raised to be told that if we were still a Hindu culture, you would be of this caste, because so much of part of being Muslim is to kind of let go of that casteism. So that's why I'm finding it a little bit difficult to answer this question.
Did that get your question, Thomas, in New York, or did you want to get your other question in? Thomas in New York, are you with us, or thought I had your line open if you hit your mute button?
Hello, can I be heard?
Okay, yes, sir, we can hear you.
Okay, I think you muted me. I'm sorry. I read your piece about dating white men and AAPI voices, and I thought, you know, did a pretty good job. I had a few questions about that, but when you said you were harassed in D.C. after 9/11, who harassed you? Was it white people or black people?
It was all kinds of people. I think, you know, we live in a time where Muslims are definitely villainized and looked at as the evil people. So I definitely got it from all kinds of people. That's racism is insidious, right? Like, so just because the way it works is to create this fear in all people so that they can see someone who looks like me and say, like, okay, we are anti-Muslim. I don't want to say that this is, that only white people are the ones that are saying this, even though it is white supremacy consciousness that's kind of...
Because I got the impression that you were harassed by someone, like people who were like in the street.
No, I wasn't being harassed.
I just want to know, what was the race of the people that were harassing you? Was it primarily white people or black people?
I mean, primarily I'd say it was black folks. But that could be just because of where I was in D.C.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering that, because you were in D.C. and I know there's a lot of black people there. Do you think that the white male that you wrote about in the piece, do you think that he was a racist with a fetish for quote-unquote exotic women?
Yeah, I would say not in this case, not for this one. But I do feel like I've dated other people who do look at South Asian women as a fetish.
Did he cheat on you with a white woman or with another Asian woman?
Another woman of color.
Another woman of color. Did he marry a woman of color or a white woman?
She was half East Asian, half white.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, thank you for answering my questions. That's all I had. Thank you.
For sure. This, I believe, is our caller in Canada. Did you have a question for Taz? You should be with us.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Hey, guys. I have one question. I was reading your article, and when your mother suggested to you that, you know, you look at dating a white man, when you said, it's like being with the colonizer or an oppressor, I can't do that. Is this advice you would give in general to brown women, or is that something you believe you should just, you keep that more your personal thing, or do you think it's something that brown folks should keep in mind in general when dating?
I think that there's a lot of concern when I wrote my article. People were like, why are you giving this kind of advice? And I was really particular in how I wrote this piece to not say that the words that I was writing was advice. I was definitely rooting the whole narrative in my personal experience. And I was also trying to like chart how preferences change over the course of your life. So what was your preference when you were, you know, like what was your preference when you were a teenager? What was your preference when you're like, you know, in your 20s, coming to your racial consciousness? What's your preference when you're in your late 20s, and what's your preference when you're past that? I think so I was really particular. I'm not giving any kind of advice. People can date whoever they want to date. I just challenge everyone to check themselves and check their internalized biases when they say that they like tall, dark, and handsome men. You know, like, what's at the root of that, and what's at the root of why you choose what you choose?
Did that answer your question, sir?
Okay. Yeah, that was a good answer, because I thought that would be good general advice, actually. When I saw that, actually, I didn't actually get a defensiveness. I thought, actually, that makes a lot of sense. But I have another question. Do you know, because I remember you said about, again, relating to the incident with your mother, that she never brought up any other person besides white. Do you know what your family or your mother or any of your friends who are same racial ethnic background as you, what they think, what they would think about you dating a black person or a Southeast Asian person?
I think at this point, I don't know. I guess it's complicated. I was raised in a very strict Muslim household. So, the interaction that my parents had as they became more, assimilated into this country, they became more comfortable with African Americans because they saw them in the mosque, right? So I think they were really, they became more comfortable with the kind of people that they would see in the mosque. So I think if I was to date a black Muslim, I think my family would be completely fine with it. I think if I was to date anyone of any race that's Muslim, they'd be okay with it. I think the issues are going to be having to date people that are non-Muslims more than it is going to be dating non-South Asian. But I think that's just because I come from a very religious kind of a household.
Right on. Hang tight, caller in Canada. I just want to try and see if we can get as many of the callers in as possible. The other caller that dialed in on a vote line, if you're on the vote line and you had a question for Taz, you should be with us. Feel free. Other caller dialed in on the vote line. Did you have a question for Taz, or are you just listening? Don't know if you hit your mute button, but we are not hearing you. Check one more time before I get the next caller. If you're on the vote line, if you had a question, feel free. Not hearing you. Not sure if there are some audio issues or what have you on your end, but just go to the next caller at 2740, last four digits, 2740. Did you have a question for Taz? You should be with us.
Yes, this is Dale. I appreciate the opportunity, guys.
Your volume is kind of low. If you could speak up, please.
Okay, I appreciate the opportunity to extend my question. I have Muslims in my family, and they have engrossed in relationships with Muslims that have transplanted to the United States. And I found that a lot of them, especially when they get together and they have an opportunity to talk to African Americans, a lot of them are beginning to realize that African Americans being traded by white America overseas and to come here and meet one was a very sincere contrast to what they thought. Have you come across that, and how have you received it?
You were a little fuzzy there. Gus, were you able to catch the question?
I think, if I understood it correctly, I think he said that he has Muslims in his family, and that the perception of black people, he said African Americans, their perception overseas is very different than what you would see when you get here and you actually meet black people. And he said that the people that he's known, that it's been like a really eye-opening experience when they contrast what's projected versus the black people that they meet. And he said, have you encountered that same experience? And if so, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of tend to agree with that. I think when I'm going to speak from my experience of traveling in South Asia, that when you're there, the only time that you see black folks is really in these terrible American movies that get imported, you know, the top bestsellers where it's just, you know, you don't get the socially conscious movies about black folks playing in India, right? So because you have this like pop media that's kind of projecting blackness in South Asia, when the immigrants come to the U.S., they have to, you know, uneducate the biases that they've internalized from the media that they've been exposed to. And of course, people can either make the choice or they choose not to make the choice. I think that's got to be changing by now because of the internet, because of how much more media is how much more accessible media is around the world. I would imagine that these perceptions are changing, but I do remember that in South Asia and in India and Bangladesh and Nepal, like these countries are very much, you know, are only able to get bits and pieces of other races in their media, and not just black folks. I would say in like Latino and East Asian types of media, you know, like I think how U.S. media portrays people of color in a really negative light is all over the world.
Massive military campaign, in my opinion, the projection of non-white people worldwide. The caller at 1078. Did you have a question for Taz? You should be with us.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Good evening. This is Devin from Miami.
Greetings.
Hey, how you doing? I wanted to ask you, in regards to John, do you think that John was practicing racism by telling you about his sex life?
Oh, that's interesting. No, I don't think in that particular case. I think people do get comfortable with speaking to me on very personal issues really fast because of the things that I write. So I would say that I talk in real life with a lot of people about dating and sex lives and what have you. And I don't think in that particular sentence in that conversation was race.
Oh, okay.
It was just kind of like carrying on a conversation that we've been having.
Understood. Now, in regards to him getting explicit and explaining to you that his wife was involved with another male and he was in fact involved with a female outside of his relationship, do you think that he was propositioning you for sex with that statement?
Nope.
Did you say?
Yeah,
hello?
I don't think so. Oh, I said no.
Oh, okay. All right, and I think that question was already asked. Now, what do you mean by political identity?
Where?
Like you stated you're aware of your political identity, and I was wondering what you meant by that exactly.
Yeah, I think for me, when I think about political identity, I think of how, you know, identity is a I think about what I mean of being a person of color, being a South Asian, being a Muslim, being an Asian American. So I think for me, really understanding what those identities are that I'm, you know, that are placed on me, but also that I empower, really trying to figure out what those are. That's kind of what I mean by political identity. And then on top of that, I do politics, right? So I work in the field of organizing people around particular racial or ethnic identities. So I think for me to be able to understand how we create voting blocks or how we move communities and what is a community, that those are the kinds of things that I'm thinking about when I look at the words political identity.
All right, thank you. I'll stay listening to the show. I appreciate your answering my questions. And yeah, that's a very great article you wrote.
Thank you. Let's get some women asking some questions. This is very male-heavy.
My wife is listening. She'll be asking some questions shortly, I'm sure.
Right on. Roz dialed in, I think. This is Roz, another male, sorry. Did you have a question for Taz?
Are you dialed in?
Can I be heard, Gus?
Yes, sir.
All right, greetings to you. Greetings to you, Taz, and to all the callers. I did have a couple of questions. My first one is, in your piece that was on Aerogram, in your discussion with John, you said that your decision at one point not to date white men was political, and then it turned into something that became a preference. At the time that decision was political, what, in your opinion, what about that decision was political? Like, how did that manifest itself to you?
Well, I think I mentioned it in the article, right? Like, I talk about the sentence that, I don't have it in front of me, that Gus read, that paragraph, that's what was the political decision. It was the choice of not dating a white person because I was trying to come to my own political identity. But then I think that changes, right? Your preferences change as you grow.
All right, thank you. And I wanted to ask, have you ever read the works of Dr. Francis Press Welsing, Dr. Narinda Anu, or Neely Fuller?
You're coming in very blurry. Could you?
I'm sorry. Can you hear me better?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to ask if you have ever read the works of Dr. Francis Press Welsing, Dr. Narinda Anu, or Neely Fuller?
No, I haven't.
Okay, I would just say, in my opinion, they're like the holy trinity of getting a really great working understanding of racism, white supremacy, and how it works. So if you do ever get the opportunity, I would just say definitely you would want to read those books. It'll really help you quite a bit. And just my last question, do you believe the Bangladeshi struggle against racism should be aligned with the struggle of American Africans? And if so, why? Thank you for taking my questions and my call.
Yeah, I definitely think the struggles of Bangladeshi Americans need to be aligned with black folks. I think the struggles of all Asian Americans need to be aligned with black folks. I think that if we are truly interested in smashing white supremacy and truly interested in creating a society where all people are equal, then that's step one to get that done.
Right on. Appreciate that, Roz. Person called in on the different person. If you dialed in on the vote line and you had a question for Taz, you should be with us.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. Hi. I'm calling in from Canada, specifically Toronto. I'm a black woman, and I have a question for Tazila. Did I say that right?
Tazila, yeah.
Tazila. Okay, so... I'm wondering, based on your observations, how would you compare the U.S. and Canada in terms of South Asian identity and anti-racism?
Well, from what I understand, I haven't been to Canada in a while, and from what I understand is that in Canada it's more of a melting pot, so people are the identity construct is around trying to I can't remember. So I feel like it's multiculturalism in Canada, right? So it's more people are asked to kind of preserve their own identities and just be together. In the U.S., it's more of an assimilation narrative. So it's about being in the U.S. and, everyone has to buy into it. So that's kind of been interesting to play out. I don't see it playing out too much in person because there isn't like much interaction, but I see it play out on my like Facebook wall between people because I've one of the arguments I had with someone who was a South Asian in Canada was about this thing about how South Asians or how Muslim women need to just stop interacting within themselves, and I thought that was really interesting because I don't see that happening in the U.S. You see more people interacting with each other. I don't know. So that's one example, but I'd like to compare a little bit better firsthand.
Well, thank you. I'm on the same boat. I'm just interested in seeing the global nuances and degrees as to how anti-blackness plays out in Asian communities, because I think we don't have that conversation often enough.
Yeah, we don't.
But thank you very much.
For sure. Thank you. See, our caller in Michigan stole her question earlier, but good that she dialed in. Maybe she'll have some other ones to ask. Did you have questions for Taz?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, and good evening, Taz, and to all the callers and listeners. Well, Gus, yes, you did steal my question, but I'm glad because I do have other questions. But according to my tally, she is the first non-white person who said that that whites are most confused. I'm sorry, wait. Blacks are most confused, non-whites, excuse me. But my question is, you said, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I heard you say that all people practice racism. Was that correct?
I think there's bias amongst all people. But I don't think it's personal. I think we all live in this white supremacist system, so we all have that kind of indoctrination within us.
Okay. Well, do you think it's wise for non-white people to be suspicious of all white people?
I think people should be suspicious of all people. I think people of color should be suspicious of all people. I don't know if that's what I should be
and
saying
I'm
not, but...
Did you agree with Gus's definition at the beginning? My call was dropping a couple times, so Okay. And so I'm specifically just wondering about the practice of racism. Do you think that all non-white people should be suspicious of all white people?
Yeah, I do. I also think, though, that there are some people of color who carry through on white, like on behalf of white supremacy too, right? So that's why I say that all people should be suspicious of all people. Like in mosques, right? Like FBI sending in people of color, FBI informants to spy on the local community. And I think yeah, you can be suspicious of white people, but we need to be suspicious of like white supremacy and how white supremacy plays out on the ground. And how it plays out on the ground isn't necessarily with white people. It plays out with various different types of constructs.
Okay. And the other question I had was, and I'm not sure if you spoke about this earlier or not, but when you were dating the white guy, did you get an opportunity to meet his family? And if you did, what was that experience like?
Yeah, I met his family. They were well-to-do, upper middle class family. They were really nice. They were, but you know, like it wasn't. It was like white people nice. It was very like kind of like nice, liberal, just kind of surfacey level. Don't really get into issues. But I mean, they were nice and polite. But I think that's, I don't know, that's, it was just such a different experience than the one that I was raised in.
And, okay. Did he get to meet any of your family?
Nope. That would have been super taboo.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that was the only questions I had. Thanks for taking my call, and I'll mute myself. Thanks.
For sure. That is the first time I've ever heard that. White people nice. I'm going to use that in the future. White people nice. The color.
You know what I mean by that, right? Like, that's the people. Just like one of those, like, super liberally nice. Just nice.
The way you explained it to our caller in Michigan, I think I got what you were explaining. I guess you can set me straight. It seems like being polite, not necessarily
authentic or sincere, but certainly being polite. Is that in the ballpark?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm only going to be able to take a couple more questions because I got to jump off the line soon.
Oh, for sure. This should be our last caller, and then I think one person did have a question, so this should be our last two then. The caller at 3979, did you have a question for Taz? You should be with us.
Yes. My name is Norm. I'm calling from Miami. Thank you for being on the show.
For sure.
I did have a question about the way that you felt about dating white men or white boys as a child, because I kind of felt the same way. And I'm a non-white female. I felt the same way as a child as well, because of my relationship with my parents. Well, do you feel that the way that they program us as children plays into the way that we separate ourselves from non-white males as adults?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think we're programmed from such a young age to, it's part of the education here in the U.S. of what we're supposed to aspire to and what we're supposed to, you know, I mean, aspiration is a key word. So if you're the football player and the cheerleader and you're, you know, you have the blonde hair and you look like Barbie dolls, that was what we were raised with to try to aspire to.
So
is that what you're asking?
Yes, that did answer my question. Thank you. I just had one more question. It was kind of a follow-up. What do you feel would be the proper way to go about, I guess, sort of re-educating yourself or enlightening yourself for women who don't really look into this and kind of still have that FM attitude about non-white males?
Yeah, that's a tough one, right? Because I mean, the simple answer would be to say, don't date white males, just date men of color. But then I feel like that men of color have a lot of issues too, right? So I think that's what the end of my article kind of addresses, is that just because you move away from dating white people doesn't mean that if you date a brown person or a person of color who doesn't have the politics, then that's not really, then you're still having to deal with that political mismatch. But I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. But I do know that for me, being a woman of color, I'm very intentional with what kind of media I put around me and what kind of media, you know, what kind of people I hold close to me. And I think that, I mean, this year, in 2015, I've made it a point to read only books written by people of color. I choose to watch, you know, TVs and movies that at least have people of color in it. I refuse to watch anything that doesn't have at least one person of color. I keep people around me that, you know, the people I keep close around me are the ones that have, like, similar conversations. I input a lot of media that's by people of color. I think that's really important to decolonizing your mind from how it's been colonized. And I think that's kind of like a first step. But I mean, the simple answer would be not to date white people, but I think that's too simple. You know, like it goes a little bit deeper than that.
Okay. Thank you for answering my question. Thank you for being on the show tonight. Have a great evening.
Right on. Our last question we get in before we allow you to go back and enjoy the rest of your vacation. Thomas in New York said he forgot one. He wanted to know, why do the majority of people that migrate from Bangladesh, Pakistan, and India seem to have such hatred towards black people, even though an overwhelming amount of South Asians are as dark? That was his question.
Yeah, I think that question goes back to the one that I answered earlier as far as how media is portrayed internationally. I think there is a lot of, you know, anti-blackness-themed movies that get shown out in India and South Asia, and that kind of, and that paired with the casteism that you experience over there kind of plays out in this way. I hope that's changing. I hope that with the advent of internet and, you know,
media becoming more international, that a lot of those perceptions are changing now. That's something that we need to deconstruct and dismantle. It's really tough.
Right on. You can check out the podcast, Good Muslim, Bad Muslim. It's on iTunes, the website. It's linked in the description. You can get more information. You can also check her monthly column, Radical Love, and all of her, the posts that we talked about today, Why I Don't Date White Men, at the Aerogram. It should be linked in the description for the program. Thoroughly enjoyed having you on the program. Excellent exchange.
Thanks for having me. This was really interesting.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And we'll definitely be keeping an eye out for your future projects, future writings, podcasts, the whole nine. And hopefully we can have you back on the program down the road.
I'd love to. Thank you so much for having me.
For sure. Enjoy your evening. Take great care of yourself.
Okay. Bye.
Good evening. Context of white supremacy. Hope folks got some constructive information. I know I'm definitely going to check out the Asian Pacific Environmental Network because I had been seeing, I think Al Jazeera, they had a great documentary on Chevron and them doing all this polluting in Bay Area, San Francisco. And I paid attention because I used to live there. So, but they were dumping all these chemicals and stuff. It was like, if I'm remembering correctly, this was Al Jazeera. I think it was like last year. And the documentary, it's like, maybe 30 minutes, 30, 45 minutes. If you check on Al Jazeera and just put in like California, Chevron, environmental racism, it should pop up. If I get a free moment in the broadcast, I'll see if I can link it on Facebook so you can check it out for yourself. But I will do more work on that. That's definitely a subject matter that is super important. And I continue to get an F in that subject matter because that is one we just have not covered significantly here on the broadcast. We'll take a quick commercial break, and then if folks have anything that they want to make sure that they get in, thoughts that they heard on the program or just any other comments, we'll make time for that as well. Quick commercial, we'll be right back. Context of white supremacy.
RacismDaily.com, your number one source for global news reports on race, racism, and overt actions of white supremacy. From Asia to the Americas to Europe to Australia to Africa, racism is not a thing of the past. It is our current reality. Be informed. Be globally informed. You should be the first to know. RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Do you need a one-stop shop for all of your multimedia needs? Triumphant Multimedia is a skilled team of professionals with a passion for great marketing and chic design. Our specialties include consulting, brand development, copywriting, and creative graphic design. That's second to none. We also offer photography, photo retouching, videography, and video editing. At Triumphant Multimedia, our goal is to provide highly effective creative solutions built to suit any individual need or budget. Give us a call at 678-732-8067 or check us out online at TRIMultimedia.com.
Hi everyone, welcome. This is Justice with the Cows Radio program. If you want to learn about, understand, encounter racism, white supremacy, be sure not to miss a Cows episode. We keep them jammed, packed with constructive information to sharpen your use of words, to help eliminate the system of racism, white supremacy, ASAP. Also, to be able to invest in my counter-racist efforts, co-hosting the Cows radio program, please visit my blog, justdojusticetoday.blogspot.com.
You're just saying.
Buckets and buckets of words. Buckets and buckets of words. My finger was a little too quick on the trigger. We should be back at minimum on Friday, and it is likely that we might drop in the day before the so-called holiday, the 24th. We might hop in for a broadcast that day. Just, you know, check the Black Talk Radio Network page. You can check the Facebook group. You can check Twitter as well for the updates. You can even subscribe. I post all of the events on the Cows group on Facebook. We have two groups. I'll be specific. Facebook.com/RWSWJ. But you can subscribe to the events there. And I generally have the events posted 24 hours before the program airs. So you'll know the guest, what we're going to be talking about, all that information is available, but you can just check there. If we're going to be on December 24th, the information should be posted like tomorrow evening. You can just check it out and it'll be there. Really quick before I get to the callers, if folks have anything they want to share on what they heard from Ms. Ahmed, or you know, anything else briefly that they want to get in. I did see it was really late last night. I don't know the exact time. We had the program yesterday, so that took up a chunk of my evening. But it was reported late, kind of in the evening, it seemed, that they are not filing any charges against the officers in Texas for the death of Sandra Bland. No charges for the arresting officer, no charges for the jailers thus far. I think the prosecutor did say that they were continuing to investigate other aspects of the case to see if there might be criminal charges, but the grand jury, no indictments. Not that I was surprised. That was, you know, exactly what I expected under the system of white supremacy. Typical day on the plantation. It was especially nauseating and trashy. The Bland family, they were saying that the timing of the event, and again, I would have to double check just to see, was this another one of those, wait until it's 8-9 o'clock at night to make this announcement, or the timing of it? Because the Chicago Tribune, the article that I saw, it was posted at like 10 p.m. Central or sometime really late in the evening. And I mean, that's just, to me, that's odd. Other than Michael Brown Jr., I'm not accustomed to decisions, grand juries, or any sort of trial decision being announced really late at night. But at any rate, in addition to that, they said the fact that it's a few days before the so-called holiday, that they were all in pieces and the family's supposed to be, you know, together and trying to take care of themselves. And then you get this, you know, devastating news at this time. But obviously they were really disgusted and just trying to move forward. And they voiced that they just did not, that they were disappointed and had were incredulous of the entire way that this process has been handled. But all of that to be expected under the system of white supremacy. It did remind me, and I think I've said from the very beginning, all of the suspicion that folks have about what happened in this case, totally warranted. You should have those suspicions. We should have those suspicions for this case and any odd, peculiar deaths of black people, non-white people under the system of white supremacy. However, when I wrote about this incident and people connected this to the other cases, Kimberly Randall King, who also died from an apparent suicide. This was last year, 2014, as well as Kendra Darnell Chapman. That case got a lot less attention, but she was in Alabama. She is reported to have committed suicide within 24 hours of Sandra Bland allegedly committing suicide down in Texas.
both Kimberly Randall King's family and Kendra Darnell Chapman, both of these black families, they have stated publicly that they have concluded that this was suicide for both of these deaths. You can think whatever you want about Sandra Bland, and as I said, suspicion totally warranted. But for those two other cases, those black family members have stated publicly that they appreciate the support that people have given, that, you know, they are thankful for all that and the attention to these cases. But from the evidence that they've seen, they have concluded that these were indeed suicides, with Kimberly Randall King and Kendra Darnell Chapman, these two different black females. And I'm citing that as being important. I talked to family members of Kimberly Randall King, and I also talked to her attorney, who is a black male, and he is filing a suit against the prison, Pagedale Prison in Missouri. It's like, I think, 15, 20 minutes from Ferguson, where Kimberly Randall King, where she died. It does not absolve whites for these deaths. The fact that in these two cases, it seems that these were suicides, it just means that the system of white supremacy terrorized these victims to the point where they self-terminated. That's my processing of the event, and that is exactly what Kimberly Randall King's attorney said. That is exactly his interpretation. I quoted him, J. Justin Meehan. I quoted him in my article, and he's filing his suit saying, wait a minute, this doesn't mean that this wasn't an act of racism. It just means that as opposed to some race soldier gunning down a black female or choking out a black person, they just harass and erode your sanity to the point where you self-terminate. Just a different manifestation of racism, white supremacy, which was what I titled the article. But I did think that was important, and equally important. Kimberly Randall King, one of her family members, said that he thought it was important to get that out because frequently we as victims, we underestimate the damage that racism, white supremacy can do to us mentally, our mental health, the impact that it can have on us and how drastically it can damage our behavior to the point where we become self-destructive. One of Kimberly Randall King's family members said this, and he too said that at first he didn't think that his family member committed suicide. But then after the evidence and everything and talking to the attorney, that it seems that was the case. Even though, again, that does not absolve racism, white supremacy, this death is still totally attributable to the system of white supremacy. It's just playing out in a different manner. But I did think that was hugely important. I was reminded of that when I saw the evidence that they, of course, were not indicting anybody. Moving forward, one of the other things that I thought was important that came out today, when she was talking about television programs that she watches, I thought that was profound in terms of trying to watch, if you're going to watch media, making sure that there are non-white actors that are in it. I think she said it has to be at least one. I was reminded of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, where she says reading is more important than watching television. Amen. I also was reminded, at least for myself, my own evolution took a little bit of a different path. For me, I have a very hard time watching media, whether it's television programs, TV series, movies, whatever the case may be. I have a very difficult time watching media if there are a lot of black people in it, because it tends to be Empire or Scandal or something. It's not like these black people are in great roles and they're working against racism or displaying black self-respect and having great interactions with other black people. I mean, that just tends not to be the case. As I say, it tends to be Empire. It tends to be Scandal. I've got to the point now where I prefer, if I'm going to watch something, a television program or whatever, I would prefer it to be all white people. That way I just know I am watching all these racists and I just get to see how they're interacting and what this program is about. That's what I prefer if I'm going to watch at all. But generally, I do not. All the shows that have like all black casts and that sort of thing, I generally avoid those like the plague, just because they rarely are they displaying Black self-respect, Black people getting along, being constructive, not being in conflict with one another, not name-calling each other, not taking, you know, 30 minutes out of the program to name-call and figure out every nasty thing that I can call you under the sun. That's just most of what I've seen. Now, if there's constructive content out there, great, I'll check it out. But most of the time, that is not what the system of white supremacy offers. I just thought that was interesting. And not that it's not a diss on what Taz said. It's just noting, you know, my evolution in media content took a different path. The only other thing I wanted to make sure I got in, number one, I guess Dr. Welsing, she sent me a photograph. She had talked about it before. Her publication, matter of fact, I'll pull it out to make sure I'm quoting her directly. She's been on the program and she has talked consistently about the fact that she feels that just branding this organization ISIS, this terrorist group, using the term ISIS, and then even some of the articles that I talked about on Sunday saying the ISIS papers, that this was to smear her work, to discredit what she's doing, and so that now if you have her book, the ISIS papers, oh, you're some terrorist plotter and maybe we need to put you on a no-fly list, that sort of thing. She sent me the image from her publication, The Kress Theory of Color Confrontation and Racism, White Supremacy. This isn't the ISIS papers, but this is a shorter publication that she had before that. But it's got the image of it. It's got like a black, I don't know what you'd even call it, a black circle, basically. So it's, if you can imagine like a square, right? You just have a regular square, black circle, and then within the black circle, it's got a small white dot. And that's her image. That's what she's got on the cover for her publication, The Kress Theory of Color Confrontation. And then if you get to see the image of the ISIS flag, it looks almost identical to what's on the cover of her book. And she's just saying it to her, at least, it seems like it's layers of associating work that she has done, describing, analyzing the system of white supremacy with this terrorist group. And again, I'm hoping we can get her back on the program to give this in more detail. But I got it in the mail today, and it helped a lot to get the visualization so you can see it directly. I'll see if I can scan it so I can share. Was there anything else I was going to say? I did have one other thing, but it's not that important. I'll pause on that one. If folks have any comments that they would like to make sure that they get in, feel free. I'm a little drained. I didn't sleep very well. I had a listener who had told me that should be one of your goals, to make sure that you're taking better care of yourself, Gus, and getting more rest. And I did not rest well yesterday for a variety of reasons. So I am a little drained energy wise. So I'm not hanging out for the full time. But if folks have a quick comment that they want to make sure they get in, or a question or whatever else, if you can just do so efficiently, quickly, that would be grand. Folks that dialed in who have a hand up should be with us if you had a comment.
Hello.
Yes, can I be heard?
I'm going to go with the female caller first. I'll get the male caller later. The female caller, go ahead.
Okay, so I've been thinking about this, and I wanted to know this. So do you think interracial love on TV, undermines black love and other kinds of non-white love? Because, like, for example, you often see black men and white women, black women and a white man, even gay black men and gay white men. And if you do see black couples, they are often depicted negatively, stereotypically, and not looking to the mental racism amongst other constructive and positive things. You seldom see black love as unbroken and as its whole. It's almost as if strong black love is a step to the structure, but diplomacy. Thus, keeping us broken through media helps to create that reality. So I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on that topic. Seeing that we've been speaking about Scandal and Lucy Hollow and even Empire.
So I thought that was a good question to ask you.
Your sound, it was a little difficult to hear you, but I think I got the question. Interestingly, it cleared up right at the end. It got much clearer. But if I heard it correctly, you were saying like different media projections. You will see black males with white women.
You'll even see quote-unquote gay black males with gay white men, anything but representations of black people in healthy, loving relationships, black male,
exactly,
black female, and how that relates to the system of white supremacy, how that's impacting us. I know Pam has talked about this repeatedly. That's a big theme in her book, The Interracial Con Game. We've talked about that on the program many times. And I think other people too have noted that that is a huge weapon. As I said, that is a military campaign, in my opinion, in terms of eroding the way that we think about one another, what we think of as attractive, why you see Scandal, even the Mindy Kaling project that we talked about. That is a huge aspect of racism, white supremacy, and why I would encourage folks to not watch television, because those images, those projections are very powerful, particularly for young people, for children. They are huge. And even if it's not a television program per se, like Empire or Scandal, just the fact, well, I can't even say that because Keeping Up with the Kardashians is a program. So even when it spills over into quote unquote real life, when you're just following these people around, and it's the Kardashians and Lamar Odom or the Kardashians and Kanye West, those representations have a big impact on our brain computer. I think that's that's her whole book, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, where she talks about that, where the system is very much dedicated to making sure that black people are not working together in a constructive manner with one another, in a loving manner, in a constructive manner, in a healthy manner, to take care of each other and solve this problem of racism, white supremacy. That is huge, and we should be doing everything that we can to work against that. And one of those, as I said, is just non-participation. It's very easy to not watch this content, and even the people who say, well, we should watch Empire or Scandal to take notes and dissect it. I've said consistently, you don't need to eat the whole cow to realize that you've had a steak. I've seen, I think, 2 episodes of Scandal, and I should not have even watched 2. It should have been 1, and that's it. Because those images, they are huge. They are powerful. They get in your mind, and they influence thought, speech, and action in a way that we probably are not even cognizant of. I totally agree. You can go back, listen to some of the archives or Pam, we talked about that subject in detail, or you can just get her books where she's written about it. And I think she even has some blog posts on it, but that a huge aspect of how white supremacy racism is practiced. The male caller who dialed in, I don't even think you got a question in when Taz was on the line. Did you have a question for the male caller?
Oh, no, it wasn't a question. I just wanted to, basically say something about the suicide deaths.
Yes, sir.
Well, basically what happened was, I think I mentioned before a few times on a program that my brother was actually lynched in a federal prison, Lewisburg, PA. And he wrote letters to President Obama and the Attorney General Eric Holder. When they hit the news and people started asking me questions about it on Facebook and stuff like that. I still felt like he was lynched. But then after hearing certain things on the program, I was wondering, could it have been that they pushed him to the limit where he, because he stated in a letter that he sent to my niece that the corrections officers told him, you're never going to leave. You'll never get out of here. And it was actually 4 months to his release. When he got lynched, and they said that he committed suicide. But there were pictures that my nephew and my niece had that had bruises all over his body. So I don't know. I still think that they did something to him. But, again, it could have been that he just got sick and tired of what was going on there. And he also talked about being poisoned, them doing stuff to his food as well. So it's a lot of crazy stuff that actually goes on. But again, you really never know. You have to actually be there. You know what I mean? We can only, as family members, we can only speculate, but you actually have to be there to determine what went on. And that's all I wanted to say.
Right. That remember you have called them. Hang on a second, sir. You have called in.
Okay.
I do remember your participation before and sharing that. And again, sorry for your loss, your family's loss in dealing with that. And certainly, as the same thing I said with Sandra Bland in any of these cases, the suspicion is absolutely correct. It's logical. It's intelligent for us to be suspicious, given the system of white supremacy and just the mountains of lies, deceit, and terrorism that white people heap on us. And again, I'm not even for the cases where I'm saying the family members have said, we have concluded that this is suicide. We've done the research and we've got, you know, attorneys and people that have studied this and we've concluded it's suicide. That's not saying that white people didn't do anything. That's just saying that this manifested itself in a different way than what we are accustomed to seeing in terms of them actually putting hands on you or shooting you or whatever the case may be. It's just saying that they also can employ psychological terrorism to the point where we become self-destructive. But certainly in your case, it seems like you have evidence and what have you that's suggesting that something else might have been at play here. And that totally warranted, I'm not saying that across the board, just saying that they have a lot of different ways that they go about terrorizing us that can bring about the destruction of black people, non-white people. But absolutely for your law, my condolences for your loss. And I hope you all are persevering and trying to figure out what happened and trying to get what they call justice in these sort of incidents, trying to get a resolution that would be to your families, which you all think would be the best way to resolve the situation.
Yeah, I actually I did speak to my sister and my niece, and I think my sister was supposed to email you because I told her, like, I talked about the show ever since I found out about it, like almost every day to my sister, and she kind of like brushed off a lot of stuff that I used to talk about, like, oh, it's not like that. The world is not like that. And then when this happened with my brother, I guess it's kind of like when people say when it hit home, that's when people start to wake up.
Mm.
And she was like, wow, you know what? This is racism. And I talked to her, and she was supposed to send you an email, but I think that she got a little nervous after hearing the program because she was like, oh, I don't want my name to be out there, because she works for the government, actually. And I was like, well, you can use an anonymous name or whatever. And my niece, she just didn't care. She was like, you know what, I don't care. Like, I'll go on the show. I just want people to know what actually happened. And, my sister just never talked about it again. I did ask her if she sent you an email or whatever, but she never mentioned anything. So I was like, you know what, I'm not going to force it. But my niece, she didn't care at all. My niece, she was, I think I sent you a clip of the news clip. My niece was one of the ones who was speaking, and she said she didn't care. She'll go on.
Oh, well, sir, she has an invitation, or, you know, you or whomever, representatives, if you all want to come and give us more detail, you all are certainly invited. That, you know, is something that I definitely would want to do. And I guess the anonymity thing, I mean, that's totally understandable. White people can do a lot of damage. We talked about that yesterday. White people can do a lot of damage. Matter of fact, we talked about all of that yesterday, the tendency where we end up being terrorized, and it's so painful, it's so traumatic, the violence that we experience and losing someone that you care about and not even being able to understand how this happened, why this happened, and particularly in your case, where it sounds like this person was sending out signals that they were in distress, that, you know, they felt fearful for their life. It can be, for a lot of people, it can be overwhelming, where they just, you know, cannot process, where they just have to repress and just try to hold themselves together as best they can by not talking about it. That's logical. That happens to people that are under severe trauma. So certainly you all have an invitation. And if folks want to be anonymous, we've done that before. If folks don't want to give out any identifying information, that's, you know, that's fine. We can kind of work around that. But, you know, feel free. You can drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, to kind of coordinate things. Or if you're on Facebook, you can message me there as well. But feel free, and you all certainly have an invitation if you want to come and share more.
Okay, thank you, Gus.
If the caller in Florida, if you could hang tight, there was one other person who didn't get to participate at all. The other caller who just had a hand up more recently, did you have a comment or a question that you wanted to make sure you got in quickly?
Yeah, just a quick comment. Good evening, everyone. I'm just sitting back listening to, you know, today's broadcast, and I'm just listening to how, you know, we're talking about the media and how it can, you know, condition us and program us to think certain ways. And then yesterday I was listening to a broadcast talking about how, I guess, Flint, Michigan, how their water was stopped being taken from a lake, and then they were taking it from a river, and somehow the river was eroding the pipes, and then it was leading to, like, lead poisoning of the residents in Flint, Michigan. And I know, Gus, you were just discussing about, like, environmental racism. It's like, the more and more you get, like, deeper into, you know, it's like you have to wonder, like, what else, what other level is being used to practice racism? Like, the more and more you get, the less and less confused you get, the more you are like, oh, wow. This is racist. That was racist. That was racism. And it's like, man, what else? Like, could they be doing something to the cotton that the people are wearing on their, you know, as clothing, or, you know, certain foods and stuff that, you know, like black people are supposed to be stereotypical, supposed to eat all the time or drink all the time, like Kool-Aid or certain malt liquors or supposedly stuff like that. It's like, man, the level of racism is just multifaceted. It's just like on all types of levels. And I'm just wondering, like, what else could there be? You know what I mean? Like, are they, is it that? I'm sure they are polluting the air, the radio waves that are coming through. And it's just something that's kind of really fascinating to me. And also, lastly, I just want to say, like, I'm sure you can, like, you know, you have homeless people that are non-white. I'm sure there's a lot more homeless. Well, I can't say that, but the non-white homeless people, you can attribute their homelessness to, you know, oh, they're, you know, they're just psychotic or, you know, drugs. But I'm sure each of those people, you could trace it back to racism some type of way. Like, you know, like, I'm sure racism contributed to them being homeless and being just out on their luck, or just supposedly on, quote unquote, on skid row or whatever. It's just, man, it's just mind blowing. But that's all I wanted to share. Thank you.
Yes, sir. The only aspect I'll pick up, the lead poisoning in Flint, Michigan, they've been talking about that a lot because they have emergency levels and the water is really messed up. And I mean, this is the same state where they just were shutting off people's water in Detroit, not Flint, but they were shutting off people's water for not paying, or if they were late on their bill or what have you. But just as you said, it is ubiquitous. It's all areas of people activity where war is being waged against non-white people, especially black people. And just with the experimentation, that, in my view, cannot be minimized. We're talking about scientific terrorists. White people could be doing experiments. Let's see how much lead we can put in the water to bring about these type of behaviors. Or let's see what happens as we increase the lead levels in the water. Let's see what happens to behavior. And I mean, medical apartheid, that's documented that they've done that sort of thing before on a broad scale. And particularly when you start talking about prisons, oh, man, they are controlling everything that you get. So it could be, let's put these chemicals in their clothing or in the bed linens or in the food or in the cigarettes that they get or whatever's in the commissary. Same thing in the water. I mean, they could do a variety of things to experiment and see what sort of psychosis we can bring about in these individuals, denying them access to other. I mean, all kinds of things that they do under the system of white supremacy. And they have a long record of that sort of diabolical behavior, methodical terrorism, military science, long record of that sort of misconduct. The caller in Florida, 1078, did you have a quick comment or a question, what have you, wanted to get in, sir?
Yeah, Gus, did she say that the white male that she was with was in fact not actually a white male? Did she say that he was, like, half Asian or something like that?
No, I think she said that okay. When he got married, the person that he married had was, quote-unquote, half South Asian and half white, but he was a white male.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. And in regards to the last caller, to answer your question as far as, you know, what could they possibly be up to, I just finished reading the book Plague Wars. That's a very interesting book. There was a doctor in there by the name of Dr. Walter Bassam. He was actually charged with basically crimes against humanity with all the political assassinations he did with bacteria and whatnot. But his intelligence in the bacteria field was so lethal, they rather used him as a weapon. So somehow he never was convicted. And he's currently working on a virus or a bacteria that affects people based on the melanin in your skin. So I suspect that that's the reason why he never got really convicted, because they found those notes and they want him to continue that work. Right on. That's all I have to say.
Right on.
Walter Bassam, you can look him up. You can go ahead and Google him. That's W-O-U-T-E-R-T-E-R. And Bassom, as in Mary.
Right on. Plague Wars. I did want to get in really quick as well. If you dial in on the vote line, that's great. Folks should use it. Great hearing from folks that are in Canada and different parts of the world. Outstanding. Please tune in for the compensatory call in this weekend. I just want to say it. Would probably be better in terms of the audio quality if you're dialing in like on a computer or a mobile device or what have you. If you could use headphones, it doesn't have to be a headset, just headphones. That way we won't hear the echo of the sound if you're using like the internal microphone on your device or what have you. If you have on headphones, it will probably sound much, much clearer. And if you have headphones, I can just leave your line open because we won't pick up all that echoing and the extra background noise and what have you. So just a suggestion, if you use the free vote line, great, works anywhere in the world. I recommend folks use it, that you don't have to pay anything. But just if you have just a pair of headphones, regular headphones around, that would probably go a long way to improving the sound quality when you dial in and keeping down some of the distortion when you're asking your question or making your comments. Do one more comment and we'll wrap things up. Anybody have? Yes, sir. Well, I could hear you if you got disconnected.
Yes, can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I have wanted to make some comments on the clips you played before the show.
Okay.
Okay, the Minnesota Mall of America, I think, very smart. What confuses me, and this is one of the problems I have with the Black Lives Matter movement, is that when did a boycott turn into a demonstration? You know, if there's a boycott, that means black people don't go shop. You know, why are they trying to stop white people from shopping too? I don't get it. The point is for the white shoppers to go shopping, spend their money, and say, thank God there's no niggas here. And the store owners to count their money, look at their projections and say, oh my God, we need these niggas to be here. And that's the point of it. I don't get the reason why they have to show up at the mall and do protests at the mall. It just doesn't make sense to me. I think that telling black people, the poorest people, the people that benefit the most from a good sale, to stay home on the day of the biggest sale of the year, isn't an ideal to start for a protest, a boycott. Maybe if they just picked a random day like August 6th or October 28th or something, just so that they could prove to themselves and to the white people that it can be done. You know, pick mere obscure days, not the biggest shopping day of the year. You're never going to get that to go down right away. You know, it takes baby steps to get to that point. And also, I think that you know, if all black people boycotted Black Friday this year, they would have just had the biggest Cyber Monday ever. You know what I'm saying? And as for the spin that the Asian community is putting on the girl shooting, making an argument that they're with the blacks and against the police policies that led to the shooting, where were they before? I mean, how many of these shootings have happened? I never see the Asian community come out when it was Sharpton and when he's protesting any other time or with the other groups. But now that it's the Asian cop, you know, to me, they're doing what the Jews do. You know, they want to be minorities when they want to be minorities, and then, you know, they could go back to being white even though they're Asian, they're not white. But I want to see if I think they're trying to get the family and the community to absolve this cop publicly, you know, say, hey, you know, it's not the cop, so they can shoot for trying to get this cop less time. If the family or the community doesn't do that and this cop gets sentenced, I would like to see if the agents are going to still stick with trying to change these policies. And that was the two things I wanted to add. Thanks for the show, Gustavus. Great show, and I'll mute my line.
Right on. That Akai Gurley case, that 2016, that's one you can put on the calendar for when that pops up next year. She should probably keep an eye on, because I'm sure there'll be a lot more as, you know, that goes to trial and all that. I'm sure there'll be demonstrations and a lot more content being published. And plus, you'll just get more details about everything that happened in that. So that's one to tab, make note of for 2016. We will certainly be talking about it more as that rolls around. Again, we should be back Friday, the book club. The Half Has Never Been Told, third installment, still pretty early in the book. The first two sessions are in the archives. If you want to catch up, I have been enjoying the book thus far. It is written by a race soldier, but that notwithstanding, it has been enjoyable for me. I have been learning some things and looking forward to continuing the reading with the folks who participate in the book club this Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. And again, just check the Black Talk Radio Network page or the Facebook group for details. If we're going to do December 24th, do a broadcast, might even have by that time more information about what's going down in Minnesota at Mall of America. Thanks to all the folks who tuned in. We seem to be gathering Canadian listeners. We've done programs with different guests from Canada, white and non-white, over the years. We might have enough where we could nab all Canadian listeners and see what things they're seeing. Folks would be interested. You can drop me an email and let me know if we have enough where we could get a group of people to kind of see, because it seems like a lot of people are in the Toronto area. I know that's one of the bigger cities up there, but it seems like more of the folks are focused on that. And if we have any people in Vancouver, that's pretty close to where I am, that would be great if folks are hanging out there too. But certainly Toronto seems to have good cows following. If you all are interested in doing such a program, drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. That said, I am going to get a nap. Rest is important. I had seen it before, but I just seen the article recently within the last 7 days where it was talking about how racism impacts the rest of non-white people and being able to sleep and how that can damage your health. So I would hope that people who listen to the program, you know, do as much as you can to take good care of yourself and to get rest. I would even recommend, because of racism, white supremacy, black people might need a little bit more rest. As unless I have been misinformed, sleep is a time when your body can do a lot of things to heal and detoxify and repair from some of the damage that we incur. Might be good if you can get an extra half hour of rest under the system of white supremacy to really recharge and repair, restore as best we can. With that, thanks again for tuning in to the program. We will be back, I guess, in about minimum Friday, maybe Thursday, but just stay tuned for the information. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. You'll see the blog. The PayPal is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. I will say again, particularly this time of the year, you have massive increase in race soldiers, enforcement officers who are out and about looking to do their citations and tickets and arrests and the whole nine. Man, sobriety would be best under conditions of war, white terrorism. We want to be lucid, clear thinking, so we can make the best possible decisions to protect ourselves and other people that we might be responsible for and care about. Man, if you're going to be behind the wheel, if you're going to be a passenger, even a pedestrian, you do not want to be under the influence. You never know when Daniel Holtzclaw is going to be lurking around the corner. Darren Wilson, just let's do everything we can to minimize contact with them. Again, I say you do not ever want to be in the presence of intoxicated white folks. That is an extremely dangerous environment. It can go from zero to lethal
in a matter of seconds. And I would even say you probably want to be very careful about being around intoxicated non-white people, too. Just that whole environment. It's too much evidence that it's very easy and very frequent that people make bad decisions, and we already got enough problems and conflict with the system of white supremacy. Buckle up if you're going to be behind the wheel. Again, just doing everything we can. Minimize contact with enforcement officers. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm up. A victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.